do. I asked him to provide a brief summary of his evidence for you, just by way of sentencing. About 7 minutes, and then be available to answer any questions.
Yes.
I've prepared just a two-page summary, which I'll read out rather than take you through my evidence. And that basically picks up on that. Now, the only thing I'd like to do initially is to ask you to please delete Appendix 1 of my
evidence.
Have
you got a copy of what you're reading to us?
No.
Page 1.
Yes, if you could delete, I'll tell you why. Delete Appendix 1. Well, the reason for that is simply the chapter 3 of the evidence. That's from page, what would be just after page 29 of my evidence. It's simply a copy of Chapter 4, Urban Development, Key Related and Design Related Objectives. And that, of course, has been updated and this got in there an error. But the objectives and policies for Chapters 3 and 4 appended to the evidence of Mr. Pates. So our next show one is that my evidence is now obsolete. Rather than taking the changes, I thought it's just a delete of this. So, again, my name is Quinton Bird. I have the urban design and architectural design qualifications and experience outlined in my evidence sheet. My evidence is based on a review of the goals, objectives, and policies for chapters 3 and 4 of the Queenstown Lake District Council proposed district plan. I'll refer to the PNP together with supporting Section 42A and Section 32 reports. Chapter 3 sets out the overarching strategic direction for managing growth, land use and development in a manner that ensures sustainable development management of the Queenstown Lakes District special qualities. Chapter 4 sets out the objectives and policies for managing spatial location and layout of urban development within the district. Chapter will guide the planning and decision making for the district's major urban settlements and smaller townships, including Wanaka, Queenstown, and Arrowtown. Now, just by way of a definition, which is again in my evidence, it's a shortened one. Urban design is about making connections between people and places, movement and urban form, nature and the built fabric. Urban design draws together the many strands of placemaking, environmental stewardship, social equity, and economic viability into the creation of places with distinct beauty and identity. Urban design draws these and other strands together, creating a vision for an area and then deploying the resources and skills needed to bring that vision to life. The Queenstown Lake District is facing some of the strongest urban growth pressures in New Zealand. It also contains some of New Zealand's most outstanding scenic and dramatically beautiful landscapes. And from an urban design point of view, those things are really potentially at loggerheads. So that's really the focus that I'm bringing to my evidence. Without careful urban management, strong urban growth pressures would most likely result in urban sprawl, which would undermine the beauty and attractiveness of the district's beautiful natural landscapes. My evidence supports the Council's high-level strategic urban design approach to the challenges of managing, note here, it's not limiting, but managing resilience. Strong urban growth pressures within landscapes of outstanding natural beauty. The strategic approach involves putting in place urban growth boundaries and enabling an increase in intensity and population density within these boundaries. This will result in more compact towns, in my opinion, will achieve good urban design outcomes and is consistent with contemporary urban design theory and best practice. prioritises and directs development to locations that are less sensitive to landscape impacts, and that's onto available land than the UGPs. Without the council's adopted urban growth management approach, it is my view that the district's outstanding scenic landscapes, together with the highly attractive and characterful towns of Queenstown, Arrowtown and Wanaka, would be vulnerable to the adverse effects typically associated with urban sprawl. Sprawl of this kind would erode and undermine the unique qualities and sense of place of both the towns and their highly scenic landscape settings. In my opinion, it is vital that council protects and enhances the unique identity or genius loci of the towns within the district. And I've described a definition for genius loci, which is a Latin term used by a well-known urban designer, academic Christian Norberg Schultz, to refer to the distinctive atmosphere or pervading spirit of a particular place. And that's what genius loci is about. In the case of Queenstown and Wanaka, the natural landscape rather than the built form establishes the genius loci of these places. The genius loci of Arrowtown is somewhat different in my view in that it derives from a more balanced combination of natural landscape and its built form. Nevertheless, I consider that all three towns are of such regional, and I'd probably say national, significance or importance that they need to have urban growth pressures carefully, effectively and efficiently managed. The deployment of urban growth boundaries and the upzoning of intensification areas within the UGBs will result in more compact towns. Such towns are generally considered to offer the following urban design advantages and positive outcomes. And I'll just take you through a quick list of those and then I'll be finished my summary. So they'll result in these outcomes: a greater and more dramatic distinction in the visual character of urban, town and rural landscape, wherein one complements the other and where the blending effects of urban sprawl are better managed. Second is increasing site coverage and building height makes more efficient use of land. Taller buildings are likely to result in a greater mix of land uses on any given site. You might get retail and commercial on the ground floor of offices or residential above. You get less car dependency, thus lower consumption of non-renewable energy resources and lower emissions. More efficient and less expensive infrastructure, utilities and public services. More efficient and effective public transport services and increased overall accessibility. More walkable settlements, mixed-use neighbourhoods, rejuvenation of existing urban areas, the preservation of green space, increased housing choice from a more diverse range of housing types, increased safety as a result of increased passive surveillance or more eyes on the street, and mixed uses enable enhanced business and training activities. So in conclusion, having read the revised chapters 3 and 4 of the CDP, together with their respective Section 32 reports, the Queenstown Lakes District Council's hearing report, and reviewing subjects related to urban design issues or matters, I fully support the high-level strategic directions, goals, objectives and policies of chapters 3 and 4 of the PDP as being appropriate to the Queenstown Lake District. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Commissioner Sinclair. I'll turn mine off.
First, thank you. The presentation that you read off. Is it possible for us just to get a copy of that for our record?
I can certainly make it available. Yes. Thank you. I apologise for not having it available today.
If it could be uploaded to the website, if that's possible.
Yes, everything should be uploaded as it's.
We can provide that.
No. Yes, provide it to us.
Just in terms of your evidence, can I take you to page 7, 4.7? Just in terms of in regard to Queenstown, Wanaka and Arrowtown, would be particularly vulnerable in the middle to the adverse visual effects associated with urban sprawl. And then you talked on the roads and unique identities of those towns. Could you just expand a little bit on what the unique identities of the towns are?
Well, I just touched on that briefly, but it was brief in my summary. But the point I was probably trying to make is that I think in the case of Queenstown and Wanaka, really, it's the natural landscape predominantly, I'm not saying exclusively, but predominantly that establishes the unique identity of the place. But when you come to Queenstown and you go to Wanaka, it's my view, and if others may or may agree, the thing that takes your breath away and really you take away your memory of that place and what is special about it is the landscape. It's the lake and the mountains. The town the town in Queenstown is charming, but if you look at some of the detail of the architecture, it's not all that great. So what I'm really saying, I mean, there's some nice historic pieces, but some of the more recent stuff, all the 70s or 80s, is not. Personally, I don't think wonderful. So I would say that it's the landscape that is the critical generator and component of that unique identity of particularly Queenstown and Wanaka. I think Wanaka is probably, in my experience, the least to recommend this architecture as well. In Arrowtown, I think it's an interesting balance of both landscape and buildings, that historic buildings or heritage buildings, particularly the folk in the town centre and the relationship to the river and things. So it's more of a balance there that makes Arrowtown, the spirit of the place there, is a combination of built form and natural landscape. And what I'm really trying to suggest is that it's a little bit more in favour, or quite a bit more in favour of the natural landscape of Queenstown and Wanaka. Does that make sense?
Just in terms of compile like a Queenstown, Wanaka, and Arrowtown, where does Franklin fit in terms of this part here?
I haven't studied, but you made a point of particularly studying these areas that there were the one that you just mentioned. I'm aware of Franklin. It's relatively new. My experience, I said I haven't visited it in terms of writing this evidence, but I think that would be an even stronger case of where the natural landscape that's visible, I'm talking about the remarkables and places like that, would certainly be the most absolutely critical. Because I don't, in my view, my experience, I mean, there's nothing in the built form of Franklin that I find particularly or unique.
Was there any reasons why Franklin wasn't included as part of looking at the urban design part? It's my understanding that it's a major urban area here. I just wondered why it is that it's not.
Well, I wasn't directed to Queenstown or Arrowtown. I wanted to particularly, I was simply asked to carry out an urban design review of the provisions of Chapters 3 and 4. And those were the towns that were mentioned specifically within that, and dealt with particularly in terms of urban growth boundaries of Chapter 4. So it was not something that I selected, was asked to look at in particular.
Thank page 10, 5.5. And just on the second line there, where you talk about urban, as I understand it, urban growth boundaries being used as a urban design technique, and that they're generally accepted and appropriate. Can you get other examples of that where that sort of approach has been applied? If you can think of anywhere similar to the kind of situation that might be here in.
Well, it's modelled on sort of landscape, but it's exactly the situation that Auckland's unitary plan has been grappling with in terms of what they call a rural-urban limit, or a rural-urban boundary, or RUB, as it's known, where there was an attempt to put so much of the new growth of the city into the existing area, which is within that big rural-urban boundary, which is the equivalent of the urban growth boundary here. And then only allow a certain percentage outside, but in particularly targeted areas of settlements that already exist. And it was really a similar strategic approach has been to try and stop the sprawl of the city and all the things that come with it in terms of inefficient public transport, strain on infrastructure, the difficulties that sprawl creates in terms of quality lifestyle experiences.
Is the situation that's in Auckland and how that technique's been used, is that the same as it applies to the situation here for the Barrowtown, Queenstown, Wanaka, as you said? Is it the same, would it work in the same manner, or is there anything unique about down here?
I think it's more critical down here because, I mean, in Auckland, the natural landscape features probably a little bit of harbours, two harbours, and then the volcanic cones. But they are they're important, but they don't have a dramatic effect on people's experience of place as the ranges and the mountains and things do down here, the lakes, quite the same. And it's much more spread out. I mean, it's probably, some people might say, well, it's too late, you know, it's one of the largest areas of the city in the southern hemisphere. Here it's sort of an opportunity to not lose that almost positive sort of system.
I only had one question or one area of questions. Can I take you back to paragraph 4.7 that Commissioner Sinclair referred you to? Here you're focusing on, in effect, the evils of urban sprawl. I haven't got it in front of me. But one of the, I'm not sure whether it's in legal submissions or in planning evidence, but one of the parties has drawn attention to the fact that you particularly emphasised urban sprawl, and the policies refer both to urban sprawling and to sporadic urban development. Should I assume, and this is the inference that's been drawn in the evidence of submissions, that sporadic urban development doesn't have the same issues from an urban design perspective that concern you?
If I've understood your question correctly, do I make a distinction between urban sprawl and sporadic development?
That would be another way to put it, yes.
It would have the same concern. I'd have the same concern about sporadic development, because I think there's a definition from where I remember reading about that quote. Sporadic was intermittent, I think was one of the factors that was used. Sporadic development would be kind of development that's uncoordinated, piecemeal, ad hoc, and intermittent. And I don't think that is the way that it's more could be relied on to produce a good outcome, particularly in a landscape like this. So it has an outcome that would be equally as concerning to me as urban sprawl.
Thank you for that.
Commissioner Cox.
Yeah, thank you. Just carrying on that thing, just a minute. When you look at the maps and you turn to the firm compact and sporadic, Arrowtown, yeah, that would make sense, compact, not sporadic. Wanaka, to a sense, is the boundary there, is going to provide compact. But if you look at the boundary proposed for Queenstown, is that truly going to provide compact and non-sporadic development, looking at that development? Well, we've already got it. What I'm basically getting at was just looking at the map there of an urban boundary for what's proposed for Queenstown.
Well, I think the other word that comes up in this is in relation to the matter of urban growth boundaries is managed. It's not about limiting growth, but it's about managing it and intensifying it. Accepting there will be growth in urban conditions, not trying to stop it or resist it, but to manage it and to accommodate it in the areas that are already, if you like, urbanised or adjacent to urbanised areas without impinging on that natural landscape. And in some in case of Queenstown, they are particularly outstanding
natural landscapes.
Sorry. Dr. Reid, you should ask about that, but I'm sorry. So I think I wouldn't say it was sporadic. It's not as compact in terms of the geographical area, but then it's a larger area with, and we've got a greater population. And it's certainly focused on the basin within that boundary.
I'm trying to think how that map there, the growth in that urban boundary, such a large area, how it ties back to the impact on the landscape of the Queenstown town. Queenstown town is a very small part of that. I'm just going through. For Arrowtown, for example, sprawling growth out of Arrowtown may affect the landscape from someone living in Arrowtown. But for Queenstown, if the growth's at Jack's Point, how does that affect the town centre here or further out? So I'm just trying to understand your emphasis on protecting the landscape with urban boundaries.
Well, I think if you just need to look out behind us here, you can see that the town centre street further up, well, the town centre, the residential street further up the hill, to the point that it, without some control, it would end up going over the top and lose that sense of natural landscape skyline. Jack's Point, I don't know it that well, I've been there. But it doesn't have to be a necessary mountain. I mean, it's a beautiful, but I think there's the two elements, if you like, in my view of things. There's the mountains and there's the flat areas between them, all the valleys that sweep up into the mountains. And if you allow that sort of, it is a pretty dramatic landscape out there.
But I'll turn to an urban growth boundary. We'll say, for example, we said no development above a certain height above sea level. Would that be another tool to manage what you're talking about on landscape?
Well, it is in terms of the intensification that's being contemplated within the proposed district plan.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good thing. A lot of people confuse intensification with high rise. I mean, if you look at four stories, you can get up. There are other techniques, which I think, for example, having a greater site coverage, that's a little bit more height in some places.
I think you misunderstood the question.
The effect on landscape for the towns of sprawl, you started to talk about it hasn't gone up high up the hill. So I said rather than putting a boundary around the lower areas, put a height limit on how far up the the terrain you can go, not the height of buildings in town centres. I'm just looking at when the question was raised about alternative to urban growth boundaries, are there other tools to protect the landscape?
Well, there would be shafts and sidelines, those things. As far as I'm aware, that's not part of this plan.
Okay, that's all right, thanks.
Thank you.
James?
Yes?
I just want to take that just a little bit further in terms of Māori. I note that in the urban development area, it takes into the needs of Ngaitahu. Can you elaborate for me in terms of those needs that you might see in relation to a tool, a management tool, that could be used in terms of boundaries?
Well, I would presume to understand some of those things I'm aware of. There's a Māori design principles for how they build in the landscape and how to respect, you know, the forest and the water. But I haven't been involved and I really haven't had the experience to be all with knowledge to be able to comment on that.
How would you see that being incorporated into this chapter?
I think Commissioner Cutler assisted Bird said he didn't have the expertise to be able to assist you. So I think
I don't know enough about the culture, I think, to informally comment on how it might be done. I certainly support the idea that that is something that should be missing. It's a particularly when you get into genius like I, it's about spirit of place. And as I understand it, that's very important to Māori, that spirit of place. It's anthropomorphic, goes back through ancestors and things. So in that little bit, there may well be things that are particularly important sites or tracks or something like that that should be taken into account, but I couldn't really say anything more than that.
However, that is enough to be able to bring it back to looking and consulting with Ngaitahu. That is enough in that chapter to bring in Ngaitahu. It's really what I'm asking for consultation. That one mention.
Thank you. I'll go back to Commissioner Cox's question, if I may, for a little bit more elaboration. And if I'm sharing the same concern, Commissioner Cox, the issue to me is the question recompact. The extension from Franklin Cross to Cobham Peninsula, right around the peninsula and right out to Jack's Point, does not seem logical, and that includes, for instance, a golf course in perpetuity, which is the peninsula. It includes quite a bit of land between Jack's Point and the peninsula that I don't think is known for anything. And I'm wondering why, perhaps, and I know this isn't, that it will be discussed later, but I think it's worth raising at this point, why the same approach that has been taken with Lake Hayes and Shotover Country and Arthur's Point of having a discrete boundary around the zoned areas isn't taken here, and that being the discrete Kelvin Peninsula area that's zoned and the discrete Jack's Point area that's zoned, recently intensified in the Henley Downs area, that's just a thought to raise. Actually, what I want to concentrate is on a different aspect, and that's your genius loci, which I accept to a point. Except to me, if I were a resident of Queenstown or Wanaka, I think I would disagree, because I accept that there's some pretty bad architectural examples out there, but each settlement does, I think, have its own character, and it's not reliant on the external topography, which is the way you're describing it. You're saying it's primarily landscape-based, i.e. the mountains. Sure, that gives it the drama, but there is actually a character of the urban area, and that is not protected in any of the of Queenstown or of Wanaka. It has been protected to an extent in Arrowtown, whereas...
Because there are
descriptors in Arrowtown talking about the design and the feel. But there's nothing, as far as I can see, in either the Queenstown or the Wanaka that touch on that placemaking that you say is so important in urban design definition. There's nothing in terms of urban design to make it a pleasant place to live in. In Queenstown, it's mostly about affordability and efficiency, and it's not that much different in Wanaka. So coming back to your definition of urban design, which is quite broad-ranging in what you gave us and what you said today, do you feel that the urban development chapter has captured the broader parameters of urban design, or is it primarily focused on the historic heritage in Arrowtown, because there's a lot more push for it, which you can see, in fact, with the design guidelines, but much less so in terms of the feel of a place to live and visit in Queenstown and Wanaka? Do you think it's been adequately covered in the high level? You have said that you support the high level strategic, but I've just queried, do you also support the lower level of implementation?
I have a better bulk and draw of the boundaries, so that's probably important to note.
Yep.
I certainly accept, and maybe I overemphasize it, that there is, and I think I've used it in my evidence somewhere, the word charm. There's a certain charm about Queenstown Town Centre, the buildings and things there. Though I have laid out the scale of it and those sorts of alternative ways through things that have been opened out. Arrowtown's a lot easier because it's more intact as a historic set piece. So I think if you're asking me, there probably could be some more recognition of the built character of Queenstown. And I'm not so confident talking about Arrowtown because I'm just not that as familiar with it, and I don't think there's quite the rich character in the built form of Arrowtown. Wanaka that there is in Queenstown.
Okay, thank you. In the corporate submission of council, Mr. Pates refers to good design is an important aspect of increasing density for development. It is considered that a residential desired guide, which is ultimately incorporated by reference in the proposed strict plan, would help reinforce design expectations. Would you support that?
Yes.
Thank you, because you have several references through your submission, such as if the potentially adverse environmental effects, such as visual dominance, overshadowing, overlooking, and loss of privacy and noise of increased development and intensification are to be appropriately managed, the quality of any associated architectural design and or urban design controls will be important. But currently there is none. So is that to your concern?
Well, I'm not sure that my understanding is that there's an urban design panel, and I'm not sure, it's probably not statutory, most of them are not, but they have quite an influence over planners' reports too, in considering and recommendations for approval or declining of applications.
So
also, I think it also could come into some of the roles and assessment criteria in the plan, because design guidelines have a history of being outside the plan. If they're brought into the plan by being referred to as an assessment criteria, then they have some weight.
So you think that would be the preferable, to have design guidelines referred to?
I personally, and I'm not a planner, I shouldn't emphasise that. My personal experience is that a clear set of rules and assessment criteria are more helpful to an applicant and a designer than set of guidelines which can be interpreted in various ways because they have to cover all sorts of things.
Okay, so do you believe that there's currently a clear enough set of rules and assessment matters?
I haven't been looking at those in the
detail. I think that's outside of
the scope. In Southern Architects submission, they encourage the use of the urban design panel and feel that you should promote quality in the urban form as well as landscape. So basically, do you believe that there should be more reference, or there should be reference to urban design panels? Should that be part of the PDP statutorily? Or?
Yes, I do.
Can you give us some more details as to how that should be, please?
Well, I think that some attempt to define the genius loci or whatever term of place. And then it would obviously be a very high level, and then that could be the basis for some willful controls or policies or rules. But I have to say, I haven't been asked to comment on the fact of my brief at this point.
No, fine, thank you. I didn't realise that I would have thought that urban design includes that kind of thing, because you do yourself raise several times the need to have urban design vigilance and techniques, for instance.
No,
provided the potentially adverse effects on the amenity of the public realm are avoided or satisfactorily mitigated, the upzoning of intensification areas will give rise to the following generally accepted good urban design outcomes. So do you feel that there's enough strength in terms of mitigation against the negative effects to guarantee that, in fact, the positives aren't outweighed?
I think those things have to be very carefully looked at. My brief was very focused on stuff at a high level, in terms of a high level, there were strategic issues about intensification within the UGBs, and my view is that I fully support that. But at the same time, you've got to realise that has, when you intensify, you have the risk of overlooking black primacy, those issues that they needed to be taken account of at other levels of the chapter.
Okay, so you weren't given the brief, I assume therefore that someone else in council's team will have been given the brief to respond to that.
And that's why I think I put that statement in a couple of places. I think that is an important,
really important
consideration.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. On page 11, paragraph 5.10, I'm just wondering, at the end, that discussion in the earlier paragraphs talking about the rural-urban differentiation, and I'm just wondering what level of development you consider acceptable outside of the urban growth boundaries. You know, what intensity of development do you think would be the level that would retain that urban-rural distinction?
I would be, generally speaking, opposed to development that was not related to that, and that was described as urban, and whatever, bearing in mind the discussion this morning, because you either got an urban growth boundary or you haven't. If you're going to start saying, well, this level of development might be okay, but not that level, where do you draw the line? And are we just going to perpetuate sprawl and all sorts of difficulties? I think if you've got an urban growth boundary and you've got the clarity in the plan as it's currently worded, with a very high level of strategic objectives and policies in chapters 3 and 4, sends a very clear message. Well, chapter 4 talks about urban growth boundaries. It sets the whole scene for everything that comes in. If you're going to set a scene and then go easy on it further down the track, or actually percolate down the hierarchy on the district, then I think it's a very slippery slope. But again, I'm not a planner.
I understand that, but it raises the interest. I mean, what you've said raises the question of whether, for example, in the areas outside of the urban growth boundary, in, say, the Waikato Basin, which is on the wall up there beside you, whether, say, development of 10 hectare lots would be acceptable, or 1 hectare lot, or half a hectare. Is there a point at which it becomes too developed to have that distinction between the urban and rural? And where would you draw the balance, if you like?
Well, stop me if I'm not answering your question correctly, but I'm not being evasive, but I think you'd have to do an analysis of the landscape. and see how sensitive, and this would be something again that Dr. Reed may well be more able to help you than myself, but in my experience, you'd have to do an analysis of that tape and its sensitivity to change through the, you know, accepting or accommodating buildings and built form, however urban or not urban. And there'll be some areas, I suspect, that may be able to accommodate a certain amount of development. Others, you might say, were sacrosanct and would be very highly sensitive. So I don't think there's a nice simple answer that can say this much urban development will be okay outside the boundary. It's probably a bit more like this, depending on the landscape.
Right. Thank you. Very helpful. In paragraph 7.9, which is, if you go to page 19, it's the particularly subparagraph E, talking about a sensitive transition to rural areas. Would you see that the sensitive transition occurs on the urban side of the urban growth boundary or on the rural side?
That's a difficult one. When I was writing that, I was thinking more in terms of where the line is drawn, you know, to delineate the urban growth boundary.
Well, there's a question that we face here all the time and in this district, so it would be useful to get your expert opinion on this.
My personal opinion is that I would exercise caution, if that was the word you used, on the urban side of the boundary, because I think we're dealing here, and maybe I'm overemphasising it, but I think we are dealing with landscapes of regional and if not national significance. And if that, in that situation, I think my personal view would be to be cautious. And therefore I would exercise that caution on the urban side rather than on the other side. Because I think these landscapes are outstanding and they are irretrievable once they're lost.
And in terms of exercising that caution, how do you see that the plan should do that?
Well, again, I'm not a planner, but you pick up bits and pieces. I suppose it would be one way would be through the activity status of development, or the type of development, whether it's a restricted discretionary or whether it's discretionary or non. Well, but probably not. But I think the council would want to give itself a greater discretion, and probably that would take it to a fully discretionary activity, if not beyond, but
is
or
it
an activity in those areas when you're approaching that.
Is it a density issue or a height issue that you'd be looking at?
Well, it could be either, or it might not be either of those two. I mean, it depends on the kind of landscape. I'm not trying to avoid the question, but, you know, two stories or four stories in one particular part of on the edge of an urban-rural boundary may have no consequence. Another, somewhere else in a urban-rural boundary, might have a significant, the difference between two and four could be quite critical.
So it's really a matter of an individual assessment in that sensitive area.
The level of the activity status which now enables those assessments to be carried out.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions? Okay, thank you, Mr. Burns. It's very helpful.
Thank you.
So if you'll excuse me, I'll leave in the hearing.
That's fine.
Thank you.
The next witness is Mr. Colgrave, who has produced evidence on the housing supply and population. Predictions of both factors are critical for a range of council matters, such as infrastructure planning and zoning. Accordingly, my evidence outlines the projection reviews recently completed by my company, Sunny Mines, and the new independent projections that we prepared. Since 2014, Inside Economics has been commissioned to perform various high-level studies of district growth. First, we were asked to review the various population projections used by the council for planning and strategic purposes. Our review identified a number of issues with existing projections. For example, many assumed pessimistic tourism growth, while others appeared logically inconsistent. As a result, we were asked to derive a fresh set of independent projections for the purposes of the proposed district plan. Our projections suggested that population growth would continue apace, with average forecast growth of 3.4% per annum. While this rate was lower than the historic average of 4.3%, it was considerably higher than many of the projections for the Queenstown district existing at the time. However, the most recent estimates from Statistics New Zealand show that population growth has averaged 3.35% per annum in the district since 2011, which is just below our forecast of 3.4%. I am therefore confident that our population projections provide a reliable basis for strategic planning. The other key set of projections derived by my company were for tourism nights by different accommodation types such as hotels and motels. Like our population projections, our tourism projections also signal strong ongoing growth, particularly in light of pending airport capacity expansions, including new operating hours. Overall, we estimated tourism nights to continue growing at around 3.3% per annum across all accommodation types, with stronger growth in motel and hotel nights. According to the most recent data, these figures are likely to be conservative. For example, the Commercial Accommodation Monitor shows that commercial nights in Queenstown were 6.4% higher in 2015 than 2014. Given the local economy's reliance on tourism and the need for population growth to support it, my work clearly signals the need for the council to carefully plan and provide strong ongoing growth in both population and tourism into the foreseeable future. Failure to do so could have significant unintended consequences, including the loss of valuable opportunities to improve social and economic well-being. Overall, I consider that the studies carried out by Insight Economics indicate sustained population growth in the district for the foreseeable future. I consider that the projections Insight Economics have come to are sound and are based on appropriate assumptions and methodology, as explained further in the report's attached by evidence.
Commissioner Sinclair, do you have any questions?
I've got two questions, but I'm not... The second of which may or may not be relevant to you, but I'll start the first one anyway. In terms of your work, have you looked at all at what, given your projected growth figures, what the relationship between DAC is and what provision has been made in terms of the urban growth boundaries and how that would fit?
No.
Right, okay. Then the second one question that I've got in regard to that, which is about, given the 10-year life of the plan, how much more or less land is needed. So hopefully I've signaled to some other witnesses that that's the kind of thing that I'm interested in. So thank you.
Thank you. I wonder if I could ask. I only have one question in relation to a point where another witness has expressly contradicted your evidence. Ms. Chalmers, could you put your hand on Mr. Ben Farrell's evidence?
Yes.
And to give you context on what Charles is doing that. Mr. Farrell takes issue with your evidence on the relative rate of growth of holiday parks and backpacking. I think the easiest thing is if I just ask you to read his paragraphs 21 and 22. Perhaps it's page 21, 22. Apologies. So it's his paragraph 75
yes.
and 76. You just cast your eye over that.
Yes.
Yes. Well, obviously he's contradicting you, and I'm looking to you. I'm going to ask him the same question. Can you give us any assistance as to how we might reconcile the contradiction?
Yes, sure. Just to put it in context. So the real goal of our work was to project tourism nights overall. The student sectors was more of a sort of a informational thing for the officers. We're not sort of trying to, with any precision, say which sectors of accommodation and grow faster than others. But where we got to was basically looking at the trends from the commercial accommodation model, which was showing that holiday backpackers and holiday parks were dropping off in percentage terms. So I think the last 12 months have been a little bit anomalous in the sense that everyone's grown faster than they have in the past. So we didn't quite get it right for the last 12 months, but I think over the next 20 years we still believe that hotels and motels will grow the fastest. And just looking at the latest the information, backpackers certainly are much lower and hotels tend to be higher, although it was a good 12 months for holiday parks. So I think over the last 12 months holiday parks have sort of been above the odds, if you like, but that doesn't necessarily mean they'll be like that forever. But yeah, I mean, our goal really was to look at tourism in a more holistic sense, and the division into the separate accommodation type is more informational than a detailed projection of sorts.
Thank you, that's helpful. That's all I had.
Questions, comments?
I don't see much breakdown on the demographics except by in your detailed report. Have you asked too much on that? The sort of impact of the demographic changes?
Not for the purposes of this hearing. I guess the feeling was a lot of the content was in the report.
Thank you.
You answered one question, which was I wanted you to update the figures, and I think you said 6.7%. That was only hotels and motels?
That's commercial or
commercial. So what you're looking at, your table 2 on page 7 is considerably above your commercial accommodation growth premium expected of 3.3.
Yes.
So it's basically slightly more than double.
Yes.
In this year, and admittedly it's been a bit of a, you know, gangbuster year, but there's no, you know, we don't know that it's not going to carry on like this. So
you're right.
Taking that into consideration, and that isn't including the peer-to-peer, does that exacerbate issues in your mind, or do you think it's just reinforcing of issues?
I think it reinforces it. I guess the other thing to take away is that it's been a boom year, not just for Queenstown, but for tourism across the whole country. The whole country's done fantastically well, which is great. And so obviously we're a bit over this year, well, more than a bit over, but I don't think it'll be the case that we could sustain that forever, and capacity constraints will start to kick in eventually. So while the airport capacity will expand, that will reach some limit. Commercial accommodation will reach some limit. So let's enjoy the boom while we can, but I would be very surprised if we could sustain that for 20 years.
Okay.
There'll be certain constraints that kick in eventually. So I think maybe the 3.3 is still a little bit conservative as a 20-year view, but I certainly would have liked to bump it up to 6.4.
Okay. good. Okay, thank you. And then just wondering, looking at your peer-to-peer, I don't see, or sorry, the figure three, where you include peer-to-peer, but I don't quite understand, and maybe it's just not seeing it correctly, how much of a percentage you're thinking of that will be peer-to-peer? Like, what's the growth you foresee?
Unfortunately, some of the graphs haven't rendered very well. Sorry about that. Our starting point was that for every 10 commercial accommodation nights, there were 2 peer-to-peer. There's actually no really good information on this.
So that's
the best we've got is a 10-2 ratio. And what we said was that we thought that would start to grow slowly over time. Our experience is that things like Book of Batch are increasingly popular. So we sort of saw it growing organically from where it is.
And so this is slightly unrelated, but just while you're here and an expert, I'll ask you the question.
Sure.
What kind of threat might that peer-to-peer growth suggest would be ahead for affordable housing in terms of long-term tenure being lost to peer-to-peer?
That's the $64 million question.
Yeah, that's
but
why.
A very good question. We did look at that in a separate piece of work that's not covered here. Our feeling was that the overall benefits of peer-to-peer probably outweigh those costs in a lot of sense. I think there's a lot of people who are attracted to places like Queenstown because of the wide range of peer-to-peer accommodation options. Overall, it's cheaper to stay in peer-to-peer, and if I wanted to get, say, 2 or 3 bedrooms, it's always going to be cheaper peer-to-peer than commercial accommodation. So there's going to be quite a big market segment that will want that and will come because it's available. So if we were to take actions that restricted peer-to-peer for the affordability reasons, see why you do that, there could be quite significant unintended consequences for tourism. So it really is a balancing act. And I guess perhaps the other way to think about it would be all these second homes that sit there doing nothing at all, can we get them into the market in some way, whether it's for a short-term tenancy or peer-to-peer or whatever it might be? I think that's potentially the opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you. I have no other questions. Thank you.
Right, sir. Just wait for Mr. Colgrave to. Now we're going to call Dr. Reid.
First was a report entitled Landscape Lines in the Queenstown Lakes District, completed in July 2011. This was expanded and modified and resubmitted in 2014 as the report to Queenstown Lakes District Council on appropriate landscape classification boundaries within the district, with particular reference to outstanding natural landscapes and features. Following its peer review, this report was further amended. In addition, I undertook a landscape character assessment in the Wakatipu Basin and provided a report to Council recommending, among other things, the establishment of new rural lifestyle zones within that area. I have, over the past year or so, worked with Mr. Barr on the development of the landscape chapter of the proposed district plan. This has largely entailed extensive discussions with him and reviews by me of his written proposals. I did not have any direct input into the preparation of strategic development, strategic directions chapter. In order to explain why Council is promoting a different approach in the proposed district plan to landscape management, I have outlined in my evidence a number of problems which I've become aware of during my time working in the district through directly applying the landscape provisions of the operative district plan. These can be summarised as follows. A, confusion regarding the status of the boundaries of the ONLs and ONEs as drawn on maps in Appendix 8A of the operative district plan. B, the use of the term Arcadian in the description of the visual amenity landscape. C, the application of descriptions and assessment matters developed with regard to the landscape of the Wapitu Basin to the Upper Clutha Basin, which has quite different features and character, and I should say this is in relation again to the definition of the visual amenity landscape. D, the requirement that all rural general land must be ascribed one of the operative district plan's three landscape classifications, being remnants of landscape vulnerable to inappropriate development. E, the landscape classification of the Frankton Arm, which I've seen ascribed as four of the five possibilities in the district plan. F, difficulties identifying and preventing the occurrence of cumulative adverse effects within the landscapes of the district, particularly the Wapitu Basin. And G, the overly visual focus of the landscape provisions, which fail to adequately consider landscape character and its importance in providing a sense of place. The Queenstown Lakes District Council area includes some of the most spectacular landscapes of the country, and these landscapes are highly valued by both residents and visitors. It is also one of the fastest growing districts in the country. Consequently, it is important, in my view, to manage the landscape and the growth in order to protect both the intrinsic and the economic value of the landscape. Under the operative district plan, the rural landscapes of the district must all be classified as one of outstanding natural landscapes of Wapitu Basin, outstanding natural landscape district-wide, outstanding natural feature, visual amenity landscape, or other rural landscape. The outstanding natural landscapes and features are those landscapes which are required by Section 6B of the RMA to be protected against inappropriate use, subdivision, and development. Visual amenity landscapes are those landscapes for which particular regard for the maintenance and enhancement of amenity values is required under Section 7C of the RMA. And the other rural landscapes are those which do not qualify as either outstanding natural landscape or visual amenity landscape. The operative district plan requires that in the assessment of discretionary or non-complying resource consent applications for development within the rural general zone, the landscape classification of the site and its environs must be determined. There are two problems with this. The first is that it's time consuming and as a consequence convention tends to be relied upon. Secondly, it means that landowners are met with varying degrees of uncertainty regarding the development potential of their land and possible issues they might have to address should they wish to undertake many but not all types of development. Appendix 8A of the Operative District Plan provides maps which provide landscape categorisations of the Wapitu and Upper Clutha Basin. It occurred to me before when I was sitting listening to others speaking, that in this district is possibly unique in the country and that we don't need to identify the outstanding natural landscapes. What we're actually doing is identifying the parts of the landscape which do not qualify as outstanding.
Is that something we could rely on in court, Dr. Reed?
Hello?
Is that something we could rely on in court?
The landscape categorisations, the maps, explaining the landscape categorisations include solid lines which indicate delineations determined by the Environment Court and dotted lines which are a mix of convention in the case of the Upper Clutha Basin and products of the Environment Court in the C18099 case on the landscapes of the Wapitu where they were drawn with a felt pen on a map. Most people's understanding of this appendix is that the solid lines are determined and are not up for further debate, and in fact the maps actually state these boundaries are fixed and not subject to change or further analysis. I've come to understand, however, that these boundaries have never been as they've never been notified. They're not, in fact, part of the operative district plan. The lines reflecting Environment Court decisions are specific to the application that was before the Environment Court and that incident, and consequently, in further applications, there have been instances where they've been moved. In contrast, the proposed district plan aims to identify all of the ONLs and ONSs of the district and map showing the location of the boundaries have been notified. Except to the extent that landowners wish to challenge their locations on their property, once established they will provide a level of certainty which should enable the appropriate management of the landscape and provide certainty to landowners so as to enable them to make appropriate decisions about their land. The strategic directions chapter of the proposed district plan provides the high-level framework for the management of the district's landscapes into the future. The objectives and policies direct future development into areas with the potential to absorb it and emphasise the importance of managing cumulative effects on the landscape. The landscape chapter of the proposed district plan provides a more specific policy framework. I consider that this framework is marginally more restrictive than the current regime, which in my opinion has been shown to be inadequate, particularly in regard to the Wakatipu Basin. This opinion is supported by Council's Rural General Zone Monitoring Report. I consider that the proposed district plan approach is much clearer and more user-friendly than the approach of the operative district plan. One specific change which has been made within the landscape chapter of the proposed district plan is to identify the Franklin Arm as an area of rural zone to which the landscape classifications do not apply. It is my opinion that the landscape classification system of the operative district plan fails to assist in the management of Franklin Arm, and that the proposed district plan allows for recognition of the particular character of the arm as a location for recreational tourists and commuter boating. And all the proposed district plan provides what I would characterise as a refinement of the existing approach to managing the landscapes of the district, taking into account the weaknesses and strengths of the existing framework. It is my opinion that this will provide more certainty for landowners and a simpler and more streamlined planning process. I'm happy to try to answer any questions.
Start with Commissioner Sinclair again.
Thank you, Dr. Roo. Just referring to the plans that are attached to the back of your evidence.
I don't have any plans.
You probably just been put in the wrong place. There were the I think they're those plans with the rural building platforms.
Right, yes, I'm quite familiar with them.
Right. Well, if you're the appropriate person, could you... there seems to be a lot, for me, there's a lot of information on here that I'm in terms of trying to interpret it in terms of that, in terms of an issue of what you're suggesting needs to be managed in terms of landscape character and that, how do these plans in terms of showing these building platforms, how do they relate to that?
How do they relate to managing landscape character? Only in a limited sense that some of the areas which have been, which are currently green, for example, the Wakatipu Basin Plan, which isn't actually identified, but I'm sure you can pick which one it is, the rural lifestyle zones, much of these areas are currently actually zoned rural general, and you can see by the level of development within them that they are, particularly around the lower Shotover area, the Hawthorne Triangle as it's known, and part of the Fitzpatrick Basin. our areas, their areas, which are currently zoned rural general, but you can see from us that the density of consented and existing development is much greater than over most, but not all, of the rural general zone then, or rural landscape classification as it is on the RLC.
And in terms of the difference between the Rockatibby Basin and then the, how it applies in terms of the second one, the area around Wanaka on that, the difference between what you're able to read off this one compared to the situation in this one?
Well, these maps don't help all that much in that regard, and that's part of the idea of focusing on landscape character, because the characters are very different between the Wakatibu Basin and the Upper Clutha Basin. The idea is that there should be enough flexibility to address the character of the context of a proposed development, to see whether or not it fits in, I suppose is what is the easiest way to put it. So there's no idea that all of the rural landscape classification is of a similar character, more that it's of a similar quality, and that there are areas within that may absorb certain development and there are areas within that will not, but that's largely determined on the character of the vicinity of the proposal.
Turning to your evidence on page 9. Page 9, that paragraph at the bottom in the middle there, where you talk about the assessment effects on landscape character with effects on visual amenity and matters raised on ecological functioning. Could you explain to me more about how they're mixed? Is that in terms of...
I'm sorry, I'm having trouble finding the paragraph.
5.9? Page 9?
Yes, sorry. Yes.
The mix of assessment of effects on landscape character with visual amenity and the matters raised in ecological functioning beyond that. Is that something is that within the current plan?
Yes.
And so in what way is that a problem, and how is it being addressed?
Well, landscape character is about it has a whole raft of different contributing factors, like the settlement pattern, the common species of trees or other vegetation that might characterise that area, the landforms. There are a whole lot of different things. Now, landscape character exists whether there's anyone there to see it or not. I guess that if there's no one there to see it, there's no one there to identify it. But nonetheless, landscape character is not... Landscape character can be changed by... By definition, inappropriate changes will change the character. If you want to sustain a character, things need to be similar. Maybe that's the easiest way to put it. Visual effects are to do with what you can see. So the effect on people, on views. For example, if somebody, there's a particularly scenic view. Like, for example, if you were to build a multi-storey tower block across the road from here, it would affect the visual amenity of the users of this hotel because it would obstruct their view of Cecil Peak. That's a very coarse way of describing it. But visual amenity is the pleasure that is gained from visual the visual reason of the scenery, if you like. So those two things are actually quite different, but the current assessment method confuses them, which makes it very difficult, in my opinion, to clarify what it is that you're talking about when you're making an assessment.
Excuse me, could you just repeat that? I was trying to take a note. I missed you said the current assessment does what?
It confuses visual effects with character effects. Character effects are more readily susceptible to objective analysis than visual effects.
So can I just ask a question for clarification there? So there are the visual and there are the character effects. Are they both relevant, and if so, equally relevant with regard to landscape assessment?
Yes. And then the current assessment map is also asked questions about ecological functioning, which some landscape architects would argue very vociferously with me, but in my opinion, it's beyond the expertise of most landscape architects. We take a stab at that, and we're probably more familiar with, most of us anyway, would be more familiar with have a basic ability to assess ecological functioning, but it's very basic in most cases.
Is the ecological functioning part then not included from your perspective in the assessment that's included in the plan?
In the proposed plan? No, I think that's been separated off more clearly to be a focus of ecological assessment.
In terms of the way this part of the plan being the strategic part, I mean, the linkages, which I understand will be later on in the rural part, are there any issues from a landscape perspective in terms of looking at on the strategic part that we should be aware of when we're considering the rural, where there are specific provisions for things like, my understanding is, we're looking at the method of including the method is the lines on the plan we're considering in the strategic part, where the lines go, that's something that we're not dealing with in the strength of the hearing. Are there issues that we should be looking at in particular regarding that?
Well, I think that there's been a good attempt to carry over the clarification between character and visual amenity, and that has structured the assessment matters as they've been redeveloped in the rural section.
Dr. Reid, I want to start with the conflict in the evidence that's before us about the extent to which farming is or is not a fundamental element in the landscape character of the district. That's the problem we face. We have conflicting evidence. What is your professional opinion? To what extent is farming a relevant aspect of character, firstly in the Waikato Basin?
Well, I was looking at the map before, and I guess one of the critical things is farming is, are you talking about farming as the act of managing land or managing animals on land or managing land for cropping, or is it necessary that that be economically viable in the sense that the income from those stock or crops or whatever is adequate to not only cover your costs and your rates but also give you a return on the value of your land? And that is where it will always fall over, I suspect, in the Waikato Basin, because the value of the land is so potentially so high that gaining an economic return just about anything on the land there would be extremely difficult, I would say. I was looking at the map earlier and thinking there are some very, may I go up on this point?
Absolutely.
One of the important things to remember is that almost all the landscapes in this district have been created or modified by farming. Cecil Peak is all farm. That looks the way it does because there is stock on it, because they spray and burn the regenerating indigenous vegetation on a routine basis. That's why it looks the way it does. And the Waikato, and Warwick might be able to point out if I get things really wrong, but this is Queenstown Hill Station, that's a farm. We have Coronet Peak Station that owns a considerable amount of this land and farms it, and farms up the base of Coronet Peak, but to a lesser degree. Mount Dewar Station is one of the ones where the running of stock on it is really just a method of weed control. It's certainly, well, Mr. Bridger was to be believed it doesn't make any money.
Of course.
There's still a reasonably significant farm down through here. Can't remember what it's called now. And there's another one across here, but an intervening block of land that's been bought by developers who propose to, I think, put a golf course or something in. This, of course, is a very significant farm, which I now own by Remarkables Park. There are some significant farming operations up on the Crown Terrace, and the intervening land, of course, is much more fine-grained. It's farmed in the sense that stock are run on it, and I believe that there are farmers of the Waikato who don't actually own any land but own stock and grow crops and so on other people's land. So it's really a matter of definition. It's still the predominant management of the land or landscape is done by using animals, sheep and cattle predominantly still for some deer.
And I suppose the obvious question is, are there distinctions to be drawn in the extent to which farming is a element of the landscape character of the area with the Upper Clutha Basin?
Well, I think farming in the Upper Clutha Basin until very recently has probably been even more extensive rather than intensive than over here, but I'm not an expert on farming by any stretch of the imagination. It's certainly changed dramatically in the last few years in the Upper Clutha with the advent of civil irrigation. So there's now a very large dairy farm and a number of, what are they called, runoff blocks, dairy runoff farms that farm, that grow the heifers from weaning to their first calf.
And when we talk about, or when you talk about, the Upper Clutha Basin, can you give us an idea of what we're talking about? Are we talking about from the Clutha outlet south, or are we talking about a broader area?
But you're really...
You can come over to the map if you want, Dr. Reid.
I mean, really, I think this map shows the Upper Clutha, what I mean by the Upper Clutha Basin, which is really contained by Mount Roy and Mount Alpha over here, by the Peavers along here and by, can't remember what these are called.
Grandview
Range up here. So this is the Upper Clutha Basin. So it's a, well, it's probably a larger area and quite a different character to the Wakatipu Basin, even though they're both basically glacial landscapes.
So the difference is primarily human-induced?
No, definitely not. No, the difference here is the effect that the rivers have had, particularly the Clutha, cutting through and the layer upon layer of terraces and the expanse of terraces. So it's about the way that I think it's caused by the way that the glaciers retreated on the outwash plains from the melting meltwater.
And going back to the Wakatipu Basin, I've just written down, as you were endeavouring to, well, I endeavoured to write down as you were speaking, you said, I think you described it, farming as the predominant management mechanism in the Wakatipu Basin. The plan says it's fundamental. Do you think that's overstating it?
Well, I don't think it is, but again, it's a matter of how you define farming. I mean, I have a 6.5 hectare block and I consider myself a farmer, whereas I would be laughed out of a lot of places that don't think you can farm on that smaller piece of land. So, yeah.
So, in visual terms, is this like the duck? If it quacks like a duck and waddles like a duck, it probably is a duck.
Or a duckling, anyway.
Or a duckling.
Yes. Yeah.
And have you had the opportunity to read Mr. Baxter's evidence that's been tabled?
Yes, I have.
And obviously he has set out to contradict your evidence. And my paraphrase, this is, he's expressed himself much more clearly, but my paraphrase is that he's criticised your evidence as omitting rural living as a key part of the character of the Wakatipu Basin. And I invite you to tell me, what is your response to that criticism?
Well, I'm afraid, with all due respect to Mr. Baxter, I actually wonder if he'd actually read the entire report that he based that on, because what he said, I mean, his conclusion on the Wakatipu Basin landscape was, quote, there are some areas of the basin which should be rezoned as rural residential, rural lifestyle, some areas where I can believe rural living development should be avoided, and other areas which can accommodate the limits to a greater and lesser extent, potentially including urban development. And I actually think that's almost identical to the conclusion that I came to. I think that the issue was, I don't think there is actually a contradiction between Mr. Baxter and myself. I think we actually agree almost completely.
Well, that certainly makes life easy for us at any rate.
Well, yes. Sorry.
Now, can I take you, please, to paragraph 3.3 of your evidence, where you're correctly recording your qualifications to the work that you've undertaken, as, of course, you're required to do under the code.
Oh, yes.
And starting 3.3a, that yours was not a landscape assessment from first principles in order to identify the landscape boundaries. The key question for me is, to what extent does that qualification impact on the robustness of your conclusions? Let's ask the open question and see what your answer is.
I think to a very limited extent, in fact. I certainly use the principles, the first principles in checking the new boundaries that I proposed in the Upper Clutha Basin. And apart from one or two areas where Ms. Seaman and I continued to disagree, the predominant disagreement between us was whether or not the Tweza, the channel cut by the Tweza should be considered an outstanding natural feature or an outstanding natural landscape. And in point of fact, under the proposed district plan, it doesn't make any difference anyway, which of those classifications it has. So, it wouldn't make any difference in the Upper Tweza Basin. It possibly would make a difference in the Wapitiku Basin.
Sorry, when you say it would make a difference, it might make a difference in Rocky Basin, you mean if you were to do it from scratch in first principles? Can you elaborate as to what?
Well, I guess that I've always personally questioned the assessment of Slope Hill as an outstanding natural feature. But that has been established, that was established long before I came around on it. The Environment Courts put its mind to it and considered that it should, the evidence that was presented to it by whoever, that it should be an outstanding natural feature.
So that's one example, like the later hearing on the location of those lines will go into this, obviously, probably on a yard-by-yard basis,
centimetre by centimetre.
Those that are involved will look forward to that with eager anticipation.
And lots of it.
But that particular example is an example of one where your feeling is that, if anything, there is too much identified as outstanding. Are there any areas where it works the other way, where it might be debated that more land should be classed as outstanding?
I think that, I don't think so. I think that I've been pretty conservative in my approach, and so I think that I've identified areas that I think are outstanding that others have argued are not. And yes, so those are.
So your summary would be, if anything, it's more rather than less. Is I should be clearer. That you are conservative in the sense that you have identified more land as outstanding than others might possibly do.
Others other than the landowners who might wish to develop it, or
yes.
Others?
I mean, there were some disagreements between me and Liz Stephen about areas around Wanaka, and I thought they should be included as outstanding on the basis that they were sufficiently similar to other parts of that area that had been identified as outstanding that I couldn't distinguish them, whereas she argues that they're not outstanding.
Now, going on to paragraph 4.5 of your evidence, you said, while the management of ONLs and ONFs has been reasonably successful under the operative plan, management of other areas has been less so. What are we talking about?
In terms of the amount of development which has been consented and somebody's decided that it was appropriate to consent it, but I think that when I look at the plans and see all the building platforms that have been consented but not yet developed, I think that I just don't think people realise just how much difference it will make when they are developed to the landscape of the district. Because it's not just a house going on a building platform. Often the older consents don't have any constraints on the development that might go with the house. So,
are there any particular areas, is it all over the Wakatipu Basin?
Oh, well, it's not all over. Let me see. There are a lot of undeveloped building platforms. I think that there's quite a bit of consented development along what's known as the Spiny Back Lizard, the ridge that runs along Mulligan's Road. Although that, because it's quite a complex landform, a lot of that should be relatively well secured, well absorbed. I never really liked that terminology, that it's beautiful. I suppose that's the main specific area.
And I suppose the question for you, in cold, hard light of day, given the number of consented building platforms, has the horse bolted? Is this a lost cause?
Well, I guess that I think there has been a problem in the management of cumulative effect, but I don't think we should give up. Sometimes I throw my hands up in the air and say, oh, they should just concrete it all over, but I don't. I think that the effect of that would be too significant. I think that we need to really, well, I think that the landscape of the Wakatipu Basin is really important to the wider appreciation of Queenstown, to its genius loci, and a grip needs to be gained on the cumulative effect of development in the basin.
Thank you, Dr. Reid.
Sorry, just one other question I had. My understanding is that later on we're going to be receiving some more information regarding Section 32 and how that applies, particularly to the landscape. And I wondered, are you involved in that process at all? In terms of the Section 32 that's been...
The Section 32 report.
The report and the understanding of the cost.
No. Well, I mean, I've certainly worked with Mr.
Mr. Craig.
He's written the, it's his report that deals with that without my input. Yeah.
Thank you.
Paragraph 6.6, your links. So with that statement here, you're anticipating we put the lines in place now that they change of landscape over time. Will have to be changing the lines much?
I mean, it's impossible to know whether there would be a future design to change or move lines. I would hope not, because that would tend to suggest that the landscape management either side of the line had worked for some reason. But the point is really that it is inflexible, whereas landscape, particularly, well, in this country, landscapes change quite rapidly.
You'll know that from the applicant environmental study, they've got a different view on throwing light. your thoughts on the cost of us pushing it through now or leaving it up to individual uncertainty in the future? You got a comment on it?
I really don't have any idea how you would even measure the comparative costs. I mean, I think that establishing the lines will be a fraught and expensive process, but you have a fraught and expensive process every time somebody applies for a resource consent somewhere a line matters anyway. So,
I might be covering what you covered before, I might have missed it. In the draft chapter, there's visual amenity values as terms used a lot, but then also amenity values.
Yes.
Are they two different things, or is it?
Yes, they are.
Okay.
Visual amenity is literally, you know, just scenery, whereas amenity values could include the things like quietness or bird song or odours, those sorts of things. The things that make being somewhere pleasant that are not necessarily visual.
Thank you. So that visual amenity is that, the amenity, that's more the character sense of the landscape?
No. I mean, it would be part of it. The character, maybe, yes.
So do we have it adequately covered in the different aspects of, so we've basically got visual amenity, visual and character. I think those are the three primary ones. Are they adequately covered in the assessment?
I think that visual amenity and character are, as to other amenity effects, I'm not even sure I can really comment. I guess I've been focusing so strongly on the landscape character and visual amenity. I mean, there are people who argue that those other aspects of amenity are not for the landscape, but I disagree with that.
You said that we need to gain the grip on cumulative effects, and someone else mentioned in a submission that they felt that we had been too strong at that front. Do you think that the policies, objectives and rules currently are adequate to cover cumulative effects under the PDP, or do we need to strengthen it or change?
I hope that they are adequate. I think that we've worked with Craig to hopefully try and make them adequate.
Okay, thank you. In the rules 6.4.1.2, are you the wording is suggested to be revised is just a deletion, and then the landscape chapter and strategic direction chapters, objectives and policies are relevant and applicable in all zones where landscape values are at issue. Do you have an issue with that descriptor? In that how and who determines where the landscape values are at issue?
Well, it possibly could be clearer. As I understand it, the landscape policies and objectives are intended to, as the current ones do, apply in rural lifestyle and rural residential zones and some of the special zones when dealing with discretionary or non-compliant activities. Or maybe it's just non-compliant, no, I think it's discretionary as well. So, so that the intention is to carry that over, and that may not be as clear as it could be.
So it should be clarified along the lines of the ODP? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I don't know that the operative district plan has any specific statement that's any clearer in it either.
So if it were to
become clear through practice.
Okay, through practice, how should it be clarified? Maybe do you want to come back to us on the six line?
Yes, possibly. We should come back to you on that.
Commissioner, can I just ask a question of clarification?
Please.
Again, I'm just trying to write this down. Those zones that you mentioned, I think they were rural residential, rural lifestyle, rural general, and some special zones?
And some of the special zones. Which ones?
Yes, that was going to be the next question.
I think Jack's point is one. There are areas of Jack's point zone which have been identified is the outstanding natural landscapes, which is a specification which in theory only applies to the rural canal zone, but has been applied to parts of the Jackson Point zone in an environment court decision. And so the objectives and policies of the landscape section of the Oxford District Plan really apply there. I think there are, yeah, I'm not sure which one. I'm sorry, I couldn't tell you, I couldn't give you a definitive list of the ones that they apply to.
Mr. Barr will probably be able to deal with that tomorrow.
Okay.
There have been criticisms made of the use of the word openness with regard to rural landscape and suggestions that it should be, and that it's not allowed to be put there, and that instead we should look at protecting views.